Okay, so we're in Daniel, and we're in chapter 5. I did that twice now. Nehemiah, and of course, we're talking about rebuilding the walls, and we're trying to make application to our life, like building up walls in our life, restoring relationships, you know, furthering the kingdom of God, you know, the church. And so there's lots of things we can learn about personal relationships, you know, how to succeed. And that's what we're trying to do here. And we're in what I'm calling the third lesson. It starts with chapter 4, goes all the way to chapter 6. And it's how to deal with opposition, because Nehemiah faced all sorts of opposition from without. And then we're going to see tonight even found it from within. But sometimes that's the hardest. And so some principles we're looking at, that if you commit your life to living for Christ, you're going to have opposition. Because it's easy to go with the world, because that's where the majority of the people go, and they applaud you. But when you resist and go upstream, you know, and follow God, you're going to be opposed. And so it's really challenging. Second of all, there's often going to be a cycle of progress and setback. Who's ever noticed that in your own personal life? It just seems natural that you take two steps forward and maybe slide back. Now, what happens is Satan wants to give you so discouraged, you quit altogether. I can't do this. I can never accomplish it. And so we just have to learn how to deal with opposition, because progress and success is never achieved with one giant jump, is it? I mean, very rarely. It's a lot of short steps and just keep trying and succeeding. So that's what we're going to see here. There's this cycle, okay? And then in Nehemiah's case, success, and I think it's obviously true for a Christian, is seen in two things. Just take the issue first to God and then follow up with action. And they go hand in hand, because if you trust God with your heart, you're going to do what he asks you to do, even though sometimes you don't know how it's going to work out because you're trusting him. But if there's no action, what does that show, really? You don't trust him, okay? And you're not confident in what you're doing. And that's what Satan wants to do, is get you to be fearful so he can immobilize you. So that's what we've seen, and we're now in in this section where there's physical threats against the builders. So actually we're in chapter 4. We have to finish this section, and we're going to just look in verse 9 again, where they conspired to fight against the people. But what did they do in verse 9? Well, first of all, they prayed. I want you to see that cycle. So they prayed, all right? And so verse 11, the enemy said, they won't see until we come among them, kill them. So this is terrorist attacks to put a fear in them. So the Jews that had heard about this, the faithful ones, reported it. So verse 13, I stationed men in the lower parts of the space and the wall and exposed places, and I stationed the walls, the people and families, with their swords, spears, and bows. When I saw their fear, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. So when our enemies had heard that it was known to us that God had frustrated their plan, then of all of us returned to the wall, each one of his work. Now, so this is where we left off last week, and we're showing us how to overcome fear, because he saw their fear. Nehemiah was aware of that. And what was the solution that was in the text that we drew out last week? It's there again. Don't be afraid, but what? Well, remember the Lord, the great and awesome one. And so when we're afraid, we're usually looking at our enemies or looking at what's fearful. The storm coming. And what we have to do is what? Take our eyes off that and remember the Lord. We're going to be okay because he's great and awesome. And we talked about the storm on Sunday. In Texas, it was rain. And in Florida, it was the winds plus the tidal surge and rain. And of course, in Mexico, it was God shaking the earth. Who's in charge of all those things? That's the only reason I remind you. God, He's the great and awesome God. And if we just remember Him and He's got our back always, are we going to be okay? So I don't care if you're rebuilding your life, you're rebuilding your marriage, you're rebuilding your reputation, you're rebuilding a church. The success is not going to be found here. And Satan's going to attack us and try to get us so scared that we stop. And that's why we have to remember the Lord. So He who is with them, of course, is greater than He who is in the world. Who's the God of this world? Yeah. And now, is that always true? God is greater than any of your problems. Yeah. Now, if we keep telling ourselves that, God's greater than my problems. God's greater than any issue I'm going to face. God is greater, right? Now, that's trust. And that's what He's asked us to do. So we looked at this. God has said 77 times the Bible, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. So verse 15, we read it. It's interesting. It says God frustrated their plans. Now, how did God frustrate their plans? Well, we can piece some of it together. They had this plan to have these terrorist attacks to frighten the people. And somehow people heard this. It doesn't tell us how, but they reported the plan. Now, who was involved, you think, in letting their plans be known to faithful Jews? God. How else? I don't know. It doesn't say. And then, so God's always going to, you know, somehow work things out. And then what did they do immediately?
Back to work.
You know, it's just got to be followed with work. When's there a day off for a Christian? Let me ask this. When's there a day off from being a mother? Hillary goes, no. When's there a day off from being a father or a husband? And if the day you start taking a day off in any of these relationships is when you can start having problems, right? And so you got to just keep going back to work. And just don't let the setbacks and the discourage you. All right, so that's where we are. Getting on with the work was the victory. And I want you to see that. The victory is not in overcoming their plans. The victory is continuing with the work. Because if you continue with the work, will the wall be done? All right. So Babado's here, and good to see you. You're a junior now, right? And can I tell your story? All right. He was 2 years, and you went to school up there in Seattle. And you took some time off, right? And now you are a junior. How many years did you take off?
1 year.
How many people took more than 4 years to finish your college degree? Oh, yeah. How long? 5 years. Who took 6? Do I have 7? How many people did not get their degree? All right. And why did you not get your degree, Ann? Just tell me the truth.
I quit.
Thank you. I quit. I quit. Now, there's all the reasons why we quit. Run out of money, got unmotivated, got distracted, got married, got sick. I don't know, right? But the reason you'll have success if you just keep on working at it. Just get back to work. And so someday, Babado, are you going to graduate?
Yes.
As long as you don't what? Thank you. All right. All right, class is over. We're done. That's all there is. Spiritually, it's just even more important that you get to heaven if you just don't quit. Just keep getting back to work. That's all what it is. All right, so there's where we are. So now we're going to see in verse 16, the whole work, we're building the walls around Jerusalem, and it takes on a whole different kind of nature. From that day on, verse 16 of Nehemiah chapter 4, half of my servants carried on the work, while half of them held the spears and the shields and the bows and the breastplates. And the captains were behind the whole house of Judah. Verse 17, those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried burdens took their load with one hand, doing the work, and the other holding a weapon. As for the builders, each wore his sword girded at his side as he built, while the trumpeter stood near me. So I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive. Does he acknowledge this is tough?
Yes.
Yeah. The work is great and extensive, and we are separating the wall far from one another. At whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to that spot, and then what? Our God will fight for us. Does this guy have great faith or what?
Yes.
He understands it. He gets it. All right, so let's look at it. Now, when they go to work, what are they carrying? Their sword or spear or bow and their tools, whatever it is. All right? And so, would that be awkward? But, I'm sorry?
Multitasking.
And it'd be very difficult to try to build a house or do anything when you're always trying to defend yourself and have to fight. And when the trumpet sounds, you got to run and take care of your neighbors, your brethren down the wall. And that's what they're asked to do. Yes?
That reminds me a little bit of the Passover where they had to have their staff and their sandals on and be ready to go.
That's right. Kind of. Yeah. But let's just think about it. Isn't that our life on this earth? If you ever let your guard down for once, what's going to happen? I'm talking about spiritually. Who's trying to devour you? He is, isn't he? And it says, here the kingdom of God is going to be built, and a life of a Christian is going to be built both with a sword and a trowel. In other words, we're supposed to take up the sword of the Spirit, aren't we? And we have to defend ourselves, the shield of faith. But we have to fight, but if we're going to be working, we still have to protect ourselves, always. And that's kind of challenging to do it. And so here these individuals, they got a sword girded at his side as he built. You're doing both at the same time. And again, I remind you of what it says in 1 Peter, I think it is, chapter 5, verse 8. Be sober and be on the alert. Sober means wide awake, and alert means what? Always watching, scanning the horizon. Why? Because Satan is trying to take you out. Now, they're building the wall, and they got physical enemies that you can see. Which would be easier, defending against those enemies or Satan? Can you see Satan? Which would be easier? I think the physical enemies. You see them coming, right? But if we're not vigilant and have our spiritual eyes open, Satan's going to sneak in the back door and we wonder, why did I fall again? Now, from class, what are the three ways he gets us to sin? The three ways we get tempted. Lust of the flesh. Lust of the eyes. Pride of life. How often do those sneak in our life? All the time. Why do people lie and not confess when they've been caught doing something? Pride of life, right? Why do people end up committing acts of immorality or lusting or whatever? Lust of the flesh. In Satan, is he good the way he sets you up for those things? Is it easy to cheat on a test or do something wrong? Pride of life, lust of the eyes, whatever. And we have to be constantly vigilant in a marriage relationship. Is Satan trying to destroy that?
Yeah.
Always. And often, the reason you have these ugly arguments is which one? Lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, or pride of life? Pride of life. I'm going to show him, or I'm going to show her, I'm not going to back down. It's usually one of those, right? And they just start banging heads. Why are you laughing? Tim's not that way, is he? All right. I say this seriously because we have to be constantly vigilant. Now, notice this work. It was carried on all day long. Oh, I didn't show that. Let each man with his servant spend the night within Jerusalem so they may be a guard for us by night and labor by day. Isn't that something? And it says, I and my brothers, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us removed our clothes. Each took his weapon, even to water. They work from dawn until the... Now, can you carry on this type of workload indefinitely, forever. But are there times in life where you need to work diligently 12, 14 hours a day? Yeah. There's times that you just need to give it your all, and then you can relax later. These guys are working all day. They slept on the job, so if they get attacked, they could defend. And they're always on the defensive, always. Now, again, most of these are slaves or people coming out of captivity. Are they warriors?
No.
Trained? No. But they're watching out and protecting themselves. And if we're waiting for someone else to do the work for us or protect us, we'll be waiting a long time. We have to stand up and start building ourselves, all right? Any thoughts or questions before we go on? Marvin.
So, just for my own clarification, sword here means like the Bible or the Word. Is that right?
For us?
Yes, for us.
Yes. We're not going to carry a physical sword like they did. But yes, it says that in Ephesians chapter 6. You know, the only offensive weapon we have in the armor of God is, everything's defensive except the sword. It's the sword of the Spirit. Yeah. Because when it comes to our enemies, what do? We pray for them. We do good for them. We don't curse them. We bless them. That's how we treat them. We don't kill them, right?
And I like the trial because as New Testament Christians, our job is to edify.
Build up. Build, build, build. That's what the trial's for, yeah. Good point. We're always trying to build up those around us and build ourselves up spiritually. That's our job. All right, so there we are. Now that takes us to chapter 5. And now we're going to have some serious things and perhaps sometimes the greatest setbacks and things that cause the defeat or failure of any endeavor is conflicts from within. Because they're so undermining. When people that you should be able to count on, that should be on the same team, start fighting against you or the greater cause. Well, that's what's going to happen here. So let's look at it, okay? We're in chapter 5 now in verse 1. Now there was a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers. So is this internal?
Yes.
It's brother against brother, family against family. For there were those who said, verse 2, we are sons and our daughters are many. Therefore, let us get grain that we may eat and live. Like, what are they talking about? Well, there were others who said, we're mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses that we may get grain because of the... So here we have our first clue. They have many family or members of their family and they're starving, but yet they're spending all their time building the wall and they need to go get food because there's a shortage of it. Now it gets worse. Verse 4. And there were those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. Now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers and children like children. Yet behold, we're forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters are being forced into bondage already, and we're helpless because our fields and vineyards belong to others. Now we'll make sense of this in a second. But here's Nehemiah's response. Then I was very angry. All right, so let's talk about it. What is going on? When we see this, when we talk about the church today, God's promised the same thing. There are going to be false prophets that rose among the people of old, and he said there's going to be false teachers among us. And that just, to me, just is striking. There are going to be people that you know, potentially, right, that claim to be a Christian, but they were going to go out and start teaching false things, introduce destructive heresies, deny the master, being swift destruction upon themselves, and because of their actions, what does it say?
Many will follow.
Many will follow their sensuality, and because of them, the way of the truth will be maligned. In Titus chapter 1, there are many rebellious people, empty talkers and deceivers, especially the Jews, who must be silenced because they're what?
Hypocrites.
upsetting entire families. Is that in the church he's talking about? Now, if that was happening in the first century, do you think it's happening today? So it's internal conflict. It's almost like Satan said this. Okay, Jesus is born on the earth, and he tried to kill him, didn't he? All babies under age 2 were put to death. Did it work?
No.
No, they went to Egypt, right? So then he tried to tempt him. If I get him to sin, then I own him. Did that work?
No.
Yeah, he tempted him many other times, it says. And then finally in the garden, he tried to get him to back out. But, you know, Jesus, thy will and not mine be on. So then he said, I'll put him to death. Now, Satan thought he had won then, didn't he, on the cross. But actually, whose hands is he playing into when he has Christ crucified? God's plan. And so Christ defeated him in the grave, saved all those souls, and brought salvation to men, ascended on high, and sat on the throne of God. And Satan goes, man. So now who does he go after? He tries to persecute the Christians. And the more he persecuted them, what happened to the church? It just grew more and more and more and more and more. Finally, it's as if Satan, and I can't speak for him, but just looking back, wise up, said, well, if I can't beat him, I'm going to join him. I'll get in the religious business. I'll infiltrate the church, and I'll put my agents in there, and I'll get them to lead people astray by speaking false doctrines. And that's what we've been battling with for the last, 1,500 years, along with persecution and all that on top of it. Not in America persecution, but this has been more divisive than persecution would be. Persecution makes you stronger. This kind of stuff just splits the church. It's very serious. And that's what Nehemiah was facing. So we want to learn out how he dealt with it so we can be wise and do the same. You with me? All right. Let's don't be naive. It happens. And that's why there's so much religious division today in the church. All right? So this great outcry, when it says that, I highlight, was this a small problem? This is a huge problem that Nehemiah is going to have to address. All right? And so the first thing we're going to see is they're going hungry because of the famine, and they're not being taken care of, their needs weren't being met. And then verse 3, they're having to mortgage their vineyards, their farms, even their houses, so they can go out and get necessities of life. Now, we're going to see that with that, the people that are lending them money are charging them interest on the money they lend them. You say, well, what's wrong with that? Can someone help me? What's wrong with charging interest when you loan someone money? Specifically condemned under the old law. When it comes to needs and necessity in poor people, if it's a business thing, yes, that's another story. But when your brother and sister is in need, you do not make profit off their neediness. Because there's something wrong with that, isn't there? Just at its core. Oh, you're starving? Here, I'll give you $5. It'll cost you 50% interest. Isn't there something wrong with that? It shows something about your character. And so God always forbid it. But yet, that's what they're doing here. All right? So now all of a sudden, they're having problems paying the king's tax. Now, can you control the famine?
No.
Is it okay? Is the problem that you have to pay a tax? No, because you have to pay taxes. We all do. But what's the real problem in all this? It's their own brethren. They're charging them interest and exploiting them in their poverty. Because look what happens. They're now selling their children into slavery. Now, that might be shocking. What loving parent would do that? We have to back up. Okay? Slavery, as we understand it in the modern era, is people that were captured physically from other countries and taken to other Western nations and sold into slavery. Right? By no will of their own. This is not what was going on here. These are people. It's more like an indentured servant where you choose to pay off a debt by hiring out your child or yourself even as a slave, but it's a worker for that person until the debt was paid off. They would do that often, and they were treated well. They were fed and taken care of, but it's not a slave where you were captured and put into servitude against your own will. They were doing this by their own will, but they had to because what? They're starving. Right? You got it? So that's how a crisis it is.
And really, to a degree, we do that in American capitalism. We become employees for an employer so we can pay our debts. We are basically a slave to a master.
All right. And here's...
It's a voluntary thing.
That's right. But here's the difference. Suppose JC is out of work. He's got injured and his wife, you know, can't work and the kids are starving. They're about ready to lose their home. And he comes to me and say, Jack, I need some help. Oh, really? What are you willing to do? Anything, just to feed my kids. Oh, really, anything. Tell you what, your wife come over here, and I want you to be my maid for the next 5 years. And then your kids, I own them for the next 2 years. They got to work around my house. And I start making this stipulation. If he's starving, what's he going to do? It's last resort. Well, that's what they're doing. They have no choice in the matter. They feel, and so they're doing anything to feed their family.
Yeah.
Is that immoral of me to take advantage of his poverty to get some, you know, prosper myself? You know, what should I do if I'm really a loving brother, a Christian?
No.
Just give it to him, right? Just give it to him freely. You're hurting? Sure. My food is your food. So these guys are doing the exact opposite to their brethren. That's why we see that with his famine, the mortgage exploited, they're selling their children, that Nehemiah is extremely angry. I have this comment I want you to consider. Everything we do with our dollars is a spiritual decision. Sometimes we make a disconnect between money because we think it's a physical thing and spirituality. But money is mentioned more in the Bible than perhaps more than any other single topic. The use of money, the abuse of money, how rich man is hard to get to heaven, but the love of money causes people to lose their faith. Money is a huge thing in our life, and if we don't control it, it always will end up controlling ourselves. So when you buy a house or you buy a car, you think it's just a purely a financial decision. That's what I'm thinking in my mind. It's just a financial situation. Can I afford it or not? No, it's a spiritual decision. That's what you have to understand. I'm using what God has given me, the ability, and I'm going to make a purchase with it. And when I make a purchase here, I cannot spend that money somewhere else. Isn't that right? And sometimes when I make a physical purchase, something spiritually is going to be hurt or go lacking. And that, doesn't that happen? Every time you make a purchase or choose not to, it's a spiritual decision ultimately. Unless we're just living totally for ourselves. And that's a spiritual decision, isn't it? A bad one. And I want you to start thinking that way. Thinking that. What did God, Jesus tell the rich man, the young rich ruler? Sell your possessions. Give to the poor and then follow me. Was that a spiritual decision?
Yeah.
And what did he say? No. Couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. All right? What was Judas's biggest problem?
Money.
Was that a spiritual issue or just a financial problem? It had nothing to do with finances. It was his heart, wasn't it? He's a thief. He loved money. And it cost him his soul. And so that's the heart of these problems here, that some people are just money hungry, and that's what's happening. Money problems are rarely only money problems. Most often, they come from a spiritual issue. Most often. Now, are there exceptions? Yes. So that's not a hard, fast rule. But usually, financial problems come out of another issue often. All right, let's see what he does. Chapter 5 and verse 6. He said, I was very angry when I heard the outcry. So he consulted with the nobles and the rulers and said to them, so first thing I want you to know, when there's a problem internally, go to the right people. How often, when someone has a problem in the church, they don't go to the people that can make a difference and remedy the problem. They talk to a brother and sister and gossip. Can you believe what they did this? And they did this. And someone did it. And they complain. And then what does that do with the congregation, the family? Spread strife and discord. Does it solve the problem? Actually, it just makes it worse. So please, I'm just begging of you. When you have an issue in the family of God, with the church collectively, or with a brother or sister privately, if you can't go to them, you know, go to someone that can help. Someone in a leadership role. Who does Nehemiah talk to? What does it say? The nobles and the rulers. He's going to the top, and we're going to take care of it up here. Now, does that take boldness? Okay, now let me ask you this. When you come to me with a problem, since I'm so invested in everything we're doing here, it's very easy for me to become defensive. Because when you bring up a problem with a church, I'm like, oh man, I failed. Don't you attack the church that we're part of? You know, it's easy to get what? Defensive. So let us be human. And when you talk to someone in the church, an elder or the preacher, be very kind, gentle. Because how would you want to be approached? If I came to you with a problem, say, you know, I got a problem. Oh, really? Because you feel like you're being attacked, right? Is that fair for me to make that request? So go to the right person and be gentle. And then those that are being approached, understand it's not your work, it's not your church, it's the Lord's church. Let's not take it personal. It's not about us. Right? And we'll listen, and we'll be gentle and approachable. Yes, Helen. That's right.
And be honest about it, that you can be respectful.
Exactly.
And give bad news or things that are bothering you, and it's received better because
that's right. So who do these people go to here back here? Well, I won't go all the way back. Who did they go to originally? To Nehemiah. And he accepted it graciously. Actually, he's angry, and then he goes and deals with the people that can make a difference. All right? So good. So, he contended with the nobles. Is that a strong word? Oh, yes, Anne.
In verse 7, it sounded peculiar to me, but he said, consulted with himself, and then he contended.
Oh, I skipped that part. That's a good point. What does that mean, he consulted with himself? I'm sorry?
He stopped and thought about it.
Thought about it. Oh, my dad always used to say, how, John, did Dad say it? Engage your brain before... Yeah, your mouth or something like that. In other words, think before you speak. And in consulting with himself, do you think there might have been a few prayers to God? When he tempers his spirit, thinks about how he's going to deal with this, talking to God. Yes, thank you. But then he did contend with the nobles because they're the ones that are in wrong here. He takes them to task. And that's sometimes what we have to do. Yes. Nehemiah was guilty? Well, we'll get there, okay? All right. So I held a great assembly against them, and I said to them, we, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold in the nations. Now, would you even sell your brothers? They may be sold to us. And they were silent, and they could not find a word to say. So what's his argument? We just got out of Babylonian captivity. We were taken there against our will, and had to serve this foreign nation for 70 years. They finally come back, and you're going to take them captive yourself, your own brothers? What is he saying? Shame, shame, shame. Is it okay sometimes to feel shame? Especially when we're doing wrong, right? And they were silent. What does that mean?
They were wrong.
Does that show something about their character? Because when a person does not have a good heart, what would they do? Fight back, defend themselves, give excuses, blame others, but they have nothing to say because they know they are wrong. Someone had their hand up?
Right.
Oh, thank you. You said that. I'm going to turn this off. It's on social media. It's streaming right now. Don't put it on Facebook. Facebook is good for putting out notices, for encouragements, for announcements. But please do not take anyone to task on Facebook. Do not say them anything about any brother or sister, any church, anybody. If you can't say anything good, what's the rule? Don't say it at all. All right? Thank you. Enough of that sermon. Yes.
There's more verses on how to deal with our brother than there is on the Lord's Supper.
Good point.
Matthew 18 is one of them. So it's not just a friendly request or a self-saving request. The New Testament tells us how to handle each one of those situations where a brother has sinned against us, or whether he stumbled, or whether he has caused a problem against me.
That's right.
There's warnings very specifically on how to deal with that.
That's right.
That's right.
Go to them in private, is what he says. And if they do it to you publicly, you can instant message them privately. You don't have to respond publicly. All right? If you feel like you have to respond, do it privately. All right? Okay, good. It's interesting. Here, one of the issues is you're exacting usury each from his brother. That's interest on the money they're charging him. Exodus 22, verse 25, if you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you're not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. Leviticus, Deuteronomy says the same thing. It was just so clear. When someone's in need, you don't take advantage of their need. You just give them the money. And if you do loan it to them, interest free. Right? Didn't that seem just the noble thing to do? They weren't doing it. It's interesting, nothing is said about the work here, but it seems like this issue, some have implied, has probably stopped the work on the wall altogether. Because there's nothing mentioned about the wall. It's people, hey, we got to go take care of our family. And you want us to work. So it seems like it could have stopped the work on the wall. It wasn't the enemies without. It wasn't the fear of death. What was it that if this stopped the work, what was it? Internal problems. It'll freeze the work of the church more than anything, quicker than anything. Yes? Yeah, they're not working. At least during this assembly, yes, yeah. That's right, JC. And not farming. That's right.
And they're building this wall to protect these people, these nobles who aren't down there dirtying their own hands.
Good point.
And so, I mean, it's just, it's a kick all the way around.
Yeah. They're sacrificing to do this, and now they're in need, and now, yes, good point. All right. So, look what happens in the result. Here, verse 9, here's Nehemiah said, the thing you should do is not good. And that's strong. He's kind but firm. And it's okay to tell some people, somebody, what you're doing is wrong. I know it's not politically correct. In today's society, we're not supposed to judge anyone. But sometimes wrong is wrong, and we have to say it. All right? That's all. Ann? Yes.
When they're in terrible need and total devastation, and you're going to charge $50 for a case of water for them when they have no water?
The reason they have price gouging laws on the state books is because people will price gouge in emergencies like that for gas and everything. And then there's looters. You saw that? They're going around with bats and stuff. Looters. And then what will happen with the contractors? They'll come in, fake contractors, will repair your house, but they're actually just stealing money from you, and they won't do a little bit of work. You know, yeah, people at their worst brings out some, I mean, their worst case scenario, poverty, brings out the worst of some people. Sad. All right, here's the problem, though. I want you to see it, and I'll just put it up here. Should you not walk in the fear of our God? The heart of the problem is this, and it's the same thing with all these people that Anna's just brought up. What's the heart of the problem? They don't fear God. And the way we're going to always walk right with our brother or sister is if we have the right fear for God. Because when you don't fear God, you're going to act independently as if there is no king, and you're not going to be held accountable. You're going to do whatever is right in your own eyes. But when there's fear of God, and you understand that's my brother or sister made in the image of God, and he values them as much as me, how dare I hurt them because God's going to take it out on me. No fear of God. And he's going to come back to this again, but shouldn't you walk in the fear of God because of the reproach of your nation and enemies? So likewise, I, my brothers and sisters, and my servants are lending them money and grain. Is that where you're saying that he was doing it? I think he's using it probably editorially, all right? My brothers, please let us leave off this usury. Please give them back to this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses, also the 100th part of the money. 100th part would be 1% a month, so that'd be 12% interest a year. All right? Isn't that pretty high? Yeah. The new wine oil. So, in other words, they exploited them. When they couldn't pay the payments, they would take their farms, their vineyards, because they were bankrupt. And he's saying what? Give it all back. Stop the interest. And then he's going to say in the next verse, actually pay them their interest back as well. So we're in verse 12. They said, this is the nobles and the leaders. It's really how Nehemiah turned around is marvelous. We will give it back. And we'll require nothing from them. We'll do exactly as you say. So he called the priest and he took an oath. Now, this is interesting. So Dave says, I'll pay everyone back the money that I took extorted from them. Oh, you promise? Let's get a priest in here. Now, a priest is the one that was ordained by God to offer the worship. He says, he's going to take an oath in front of you, in front of God. What's he doing, Nehemiah? Why? Accountability. When we talk about repentance, it's one thing for someone to say, I'm sorry. It's another thing to ask them, here's what we'd like you to do. God would like you to do to correct what you've done wrong. Does he outline some things? And then when they say yes, then what's the next step? Sorrow. Here's correction or restoration. And then some form of accountability. If there's no accountability, what most often happens to that person? They slip back into the same behavior. Accountability is good, isn't it? It's healthy. We all need accountability, and that's what we're supposed to do for each other. So he shook out the front of the garment and said, may God shake out every man from his house and from his possession who does not fulfill this promise. So if you're shaking out dust from your garments, may God do that to you in your life. Whoa, if God's shaking you, that's not a nice thing. If you break your word, and they said, amen. So what are they doing? We take an oath before God. And then the people did according to the promise. So they stopped the usury, they gave back the farms, they repaid the interest, and they took oaths. And it all shows, again, accountability. I'm convinced more and more, as I see it, the reason people don't, after they repent, restore their life spiritually, their marriages, their relationship, is because there's no accountability. And that's the hardest thing to put in place. It's really hard. All right. Sometimes it's just being a friend to someone and checking on them all the time. That's all the accountability they need. Sometimes it's more serious than that. But just checking with people. Sometimes that's all it is. Calling them every day. How are you doing? I have one person that every time he's tempted, he's supposed to call me. Every time. And he made a promise he would. And I said, the day you don't call me and you fall short again, I'm going to be all over you. Because you promise what? You call me when you're tempted. Because I want to be there for you. And I might be able to talk about him, I might not. But if you don't call me, I didn't have a chance. And you promised. See, that's loving what? Accountability. And if we can do that for each other, you know, we would help. All right? Okay, we're out of time. We'll stop right there. And we'll look at Nehemiah's example next week. Thank you very much. I hope we learned something in all of this. Heather's smiling.